Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Tim, Michael, Mo, and the occasional guest discussing digital analytics issues of the day. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/analyticshour and their website analyticshour.io. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 98. There is this saying that people don't leave companies, they leave managers. So on the advice of a listener who may or may not be related to one of our co-hosts, Michelle Kiss, that's the listener, not the co-host. Not sure which of us she's related to, but anyways, thanks Michelle for the idea. We decided to talk about this because when an analyst is at a company, they invariably have a manager. And this episode is for you, that person who is the manager of an analyst. And sometimes you're also an analyst, but sometimes you aren't. And this is the one and only primer you need to connect with and manage your analyst effectively. LOL. Just kidding. But we're here. We're recording. Let's go host hunting. First, Tim Wilson. He's so passionate about this topic, he refuses to manage anyone. Welcome, Tim.
Hey, hey, boss. How's it going?
There you go. I can't get you every time.
I know.
Okay, next up, Mo Kiss, who manages all the best people in the Australian analytics community. Hi, Priscilla. And hi, Mo.
Hi, how you going?
I'm going great. And lastly, I'm Michael Helbling. I'm basically sort of this guy with some theories that may or may not work, depending on which analytics people you ask. Okay, let's get it going. How do you manage an analyst?
Okay, but like, let's get to the crux of Michelle's whole question, which was particularly about this point, and actually me and her have been chatting a lot about this because it seems to be a topic that a lot of people are grappling with at the moment, is how do you actually manage people when you don't have the skills that they have? So, for example, you're more business side and you have two data scientists and, say, like an implementation person in your team, and your skill set isn't any of those things. How do you actually help them and mentor them if you can't do their job or you don't have experience in their role?
Is it fair to split that question into, there are cases where the analyst reports to like a marketer, like they're just part of the marketer's team. And so it's a non-data role as a manager, which I think those managers struggle a lot more if they're not open to learning and trusting their analyst. And then I think you could say that there's a separate role, which is the manager has some sort of data or analytics background, and now they're managing people that really know. I mean, back when I did manage people, we didn't call her a data scientist, but she was a data scientist. And I had certainly people who knew data sets inside and out that I did not know, but at least I had the credibility it's not just a credibility thing, but at least I had kind of some degree of analytic thinking. So I think those are kind of two different scenarios. And I guess most of our listeners are likely, if they're managing people, they are people with an analytics background.
Probably has an analyst, but not necessarily. And I love that question because it really brings, I think, into focus a couple of really cool things. First off, my take is you definitely always need to or want to show respect for what they can do. As the manager, really value what they're great at. So, you know, they bring a set of skills to the table. They bring hopefully a really great skill set. And so respecting that value that they bring and not trying to make them be what they're not, but let them be who they are and value that skills that they bring that's different. I mean, this episode's going to be weird for me because I really feel like all of the advice is just going to be like the same basic like management 101 like stuff that you tell anybody. I don't know if it's going to, maybe it'll be,
yeah, but I don't know. Not everyone knows that stuff. Like, well, I don't even know that stuff. Management 101.
Yeah, like me, for instance, I have no idea. But that's the one thing. And then the other thing I want to so it's sort of getting to the point, and I don't know how to kind of make it a short description. I want to tell you a story about a manager I had who really impacted me as an analyst in a positive way, in that they had no experience as an analyst. They didn't function like that. They came from another part of the business to manage our team. Big shout out to Kirby Wanger in Wisconsin, if you're listening. But she sat down with us and our team, and she said, listen, I don't pretend to know how or what it is you guys do well. What my job is to help you be effective within our organization. How do I do that for you? How do I get you guys from here to where you're trying to go? And as a manager, it was world changing. And so I just have so much respect for somebody who is able to sort of see that, sort of like, here am I see where this all has to go. I'm in charge of delivering what our team is responsible to deliver to the business, which she was, and basically saying, now I want to free you up to do what you do as analysts. I'm not going to try to micromanage analysis. You're going to tell me how we're going to work. And if you do your part, I'll do my part, which is get everything out of your way so you guys can do the work that you're set up to do. And honestly, you know, I just learned so much from her as, like, I wanted to be that kind of manager from then on. I was like, I want to learn how to do what she just did.
Was she your manager when you left? Was that Land's End?
She wasn't. She got promoted away from us.
I just wanted to make sure, you know, your opener, people don't leave. Yeah. Make sure you didn't leave her.
No, I probably would not have left when I did if she was still my manager, to be just brutally honest.
Okay, but so what about when you have someone in your team? Like, I've just realized all I'm going to do is ask you guys questions and try and learn from all of your mistakes.
You're a manager.
What happens when you have someone in your team who's stuck technically? So they have an issue, they come to you, there's something technical in Python, in R, SQL, like, I don't know, insert some technical example, and you don't have that language skill, so you can't help
them. But that's not, you're not their Python teacher or the teaching assistant to be. I've got someone I know who I think is phenomenally talented, and she lacks self-confidence, and she has somebody working for her who is a phenomenally talented person working in R, and she kind of grapples with this, like, how do I help him when he comes to me with questions? It's like, well, you help him figure out where to go look. If it's a case where the person is like, I'm trying to show you that I know something you don't know and you can't help me, and therefore I'm going to dismiss you as a manager. Like, that's, I actually can't think of examples where I've really seen that happen. I kind of have heard people grousing, like, why are they the manager? Like, that's one issue. But I think it's not your job to say, oh, I'm the parent and I need to help you solve your homework. You know, if it's, do we need a membership to another? Like, what can I do? Do we need a subscription to some service? Do we need to figure out how an outside consultant can be on retainer that you can call and ask for questions? Like, helping them say, look, I'm not the one who can solve that, but I don't want you to be struggling and sitting on an island. And there's a reason that you are their manager. It's you were elevated. And I'm saying you generically, not necessarily you. For a reason. So I feel for the example that, as we were kind of prepping for this episode, it kept running through my mind, and I've had many discussions with this particular person because she's kind of struggling with it. And I feel like I'm a broken record saying, look, that employee's not really expecting, you're expecting that of yourself. Like, that's more being driven by the manager saying, I need to be able to answer their Python or R or data science questions. I haven't run into a lot of cases where the actual employee is saying you're an ineffective manager because of that.
I don't disagree with you. I think that view is correct, but it doesn't make you feel less shit. Like, it doesn't make you feel less shit that you don't know it and make you push to want to know it. But then is that something that you just have to accept, that as you become like kind of go up and manage more and more people, you just have to accept that you're going to be able to learn less and less and be able to answer those technical questions less and less? Like, is that a trade-off that you just have to suck
I think
up?
As a manager, your job is not to know or do the job of the people on your team necessarily. Your job is to make the people on your team effective. And so to Tim's point, or successful, actually, I would change it to successful. I view my job to create success for the people on my team. I do not know how Tim does what he does. He's the quintessential analyst. Like, nobody can touch that. Because you didn't hit me at the top of the show. So it's okay. Going to come right, Tim. I mean, you know, fight fire with fire, I always say. But that's the thing. And actually, there's even better examples, because there's other disciplines that are less, that I know even less about than kind of, you know, what Tim does. Tim does so much stuff. I mean, you know, again, I could go on and on. But the point is that it's not, I don't feel bad that I don't know. What I want to know is, and sit down and talk to and understand, what do they need to be successful? And if they're struggling with like a piece of specifics around their specific thing, what tools do they have? I mean, heck, I could open up the Measure Slack and go ask those kinds of questions. Or, you know, I am very powerful at Googling things successfully. And so, like, I can learn about almost anything, but that's not core. What's core is, am I enabling them to be successful?
Well, and on the technical front, I think there is a point where if somebody's struggling, saying, look, I mean, that is kind of very specific on if it's a Python or SQL or R question. And I have told people, I'm like, I don't know the answer to that, but good Lord, hop over into the Measure Slack, which I sometimes think, especially with more junior analysts, they're not yet comfortable like publicly saying, I need help. Whereas the way at least that whole aspect of the community has evolved, or the industry has evolved, is that's kind of, you gotta do that. You know, I mean, when you've got to be a little bit, hey, let me ask a pool of people who are willing to help. And that really, I mean, that goes back 15 years when it comes to discussion boards, people were asking questions and answering. And I think sometimes there is the role of the manager saying, yeah, you know, if you've Googled it and can't find it, you know, ask a question. But I will say, like, the macro view, there are times I have this weird thing that happens occasionally when there's some, you know, 35-year-old CEO, and I've never fully understood what the track is where somebody winds up as the executive of a very large company where they clearly progressed very rapidly, which meant they weren't really in the trenches getting deep on anything for very long.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, I came to terms, you know, 20 years ago, I knew that I didn't want to be a CEO, but that is, there's a reason that they sort of progressed. And there aren't a lot of people sitting around saying, you know, I know how to send this email blast and our CEO doesn't know how to send that email blast, you know, bah, I don't.
But I think that's the difference. Once you get to a certain level, people accept from a business perspective that you've got that bigger picture of you. Mm-hmm. But I think particularly younger companies and young leadership teams, when it comes to lower and mid-level management, they still expect them to be doers and not people managers. Sure. And that can be particularly tough in data and analytics, because they expect you sometimes to still be able to do everything that the data scientist in your team or...
I don't know that do... I think they expect you to be able to do individual contributor work. And I feel like we had this debate when we were talking to Simon, that, you know, I feel like being like, no, you know, I'm not, just because I'm managing a data scientist doesn't mean I'm equipped to do that, but I'm there to partner with them, you know, because, hey, that data scientist can't communicate his way out of a paper bag and I can actually communicate effectively. We're a very powerful team. And for this project, we are partners. And yes, I have some seniority. And again, it goes back to the employee. If the employee is like, well, what the hell? My partner on that, my manager was just, you know, just like communicating effectively. What the hell? You know, that's a little bit on the employee if they're not recognizing where the value is.
Yeah. And I would also say that it depends level wise in terms of like what level of expertise is an expectation as a manager versus just straight people leadership and management experience, because every organization is going to be a little different. I would say typically you're not wrong, Mo, that there is an expectation of some kind of skill set around that up until you get probably fairly senior in most companies. That being said, you know, is it basically
how many martinis you're having at lunch is kind of like, once you're having two martinis at lunch, right, you don't need to have any real skill. Okay.
That's the kind of perspective we need, Tim. That's exactly what happens. Welcome.
And you've reached that
welcome
point.
Welcome to Holmes. My world. Oh no, four.
The two martinis
four.
At lunch.
I'm an over.
Do not schedule a meeting with him after 1:30.
I mean, I usually don't come back to the office after lunch anyways, so, you know, I'm just kidding. No, but that is something that you have to work out. I think the more crucial thing is that not everyone who is an expert and awesome is someone who should be managing people. And so that's a little bit of a reverse, which is that's more important for the company to figure out and identify, is creating a valuable and valued and impactful careers for people who shouldn't probably have people management responsibilities or who don't even really want that, you know. And a lot, I've seen both sides of this. So I've seen people who are analysts who are phenomenal at what they do, and they can't sleep well at night because they don't manage someone. And they feel that that is the most important thing for their career's advancement. And they aren't happy until they find a job, which in some cases they seek that job out and then instantly are miserable because they didn't realize that was the worst thing they could go do. They should just keep getting better at what they're great at and what they actually are passionate about. But so there's so many voices that enter this conversation, and we kind of do it to ourselves too around this, where we kind of compare ourselves to others. And I know I did it, and I struggle to not do it now, which is, you know, you look out and across people who are in your same, I don't know what, you know, like number of years of experience or same age as you, you know, you kind of met them at a conference one time and you see, you know, they've got this cool new title on LinkedIn and seems like they're making all this progress in their careers. And you're like, I'm just sitting here stuck being a senior analyst. Like, oh no, what's going to happen to me? I remember feeling that way a lot. And I was like, you know, like I'm not getting moved along fast enough in my career. Is that going to limit me later and shut down opportunities for me? It's like, there's a lot of questions. And actually, if you're a manager of an analyst, I think having those kinds of conversations with your people is actually super important to talk about specifically what is going to happen for them as they progress through that. I want to say it was Jack Welch, and he did, I mean, talk about, like, you know, management people, like, let's go straight to Jack Welch. something he said that really always stuck with me, and this is a general principle, but it applies here too, is people need to know when you're doing things and making decisions as a company, as a manager, as a boss type person, people will need to know a couple things. They need to know why it's important, but they also need to know what's in it for them. What's the value that they're going to get by being part of this? And so when you're asking a lot of people, or you're asking people to, you know, get behind this mission, or we've got to do this for the company or whatever, what does it mean to them to be part of that? And I think when you can try to enunciate that, it can be extremely powerful, because people want to be part of something important, and they want to do meaningful work. And that's where I think millennials, frankly, get a bad rap, because I think they're seeking that kind of meaning, and people are unwilling to be expressed in their way of communicating it. And we want people to kind of just, you know, put your head down and grind. And I think millennials are very focused on making a difference in the world in some capacities.
Well, I think it's also about understanding like company values yes. and the company goals and how you're contributing to that. Like I know lots of people in my industry who the salary is not that important. It's all kind of within a bandwidth. They're pretty happy as long as, and I'm one of those people, as long as I'm working for a company where I agree to their values, I feel like what I do getting out of bed in the morning and going to work every day makes a difference somehow to what the company's striving towards. And I think where that failure of communicating those things falls down is where people, well, for some people, they find they're not as like motivated or interested or whatever it might be.
Which I think kind of extrapolating a little bit from what you're both saying and thinking about, it is very challenging for the people that we want to attract as analysts to say, we will assign you the tasks and do the tasks and get your paycheck is lethal. Like that yeah. is not long-term. So there are a few different kind of strategies and they're not mutually exclusive. The one, which you guys were both, I think, sort of speaking to is, okay, make sure that part of what you're doing, there's a mechanism for communicating the larger context. If somebody feels like they need to grow, and that is kind of management 101, what are the opportunities you're giving them to grow where they can fail and fail safely? But, you know, you don't have to be a manager to oversee an intern on a project. You don't have to be managing people to spearhead a project and get the opportunity to lead without managing. I think there's another piece that we haven't talked about that I did sort of consciously use, and maybe this was because I was still so insecure, was a level of collaborative direction setting. So back when I did manage a BI team that was 15 to 20 people, you know, we had a mechanism where we were as a group often discussing where do we want to be? And it wasn't so much top down of me or just myself and my direct report saying, this is what we're going to do. Now that you got to kind of walk the balancing act. If they said we want to be, you know, the world's best water polo team and we were selling hardware and software, that's not useful. But that was kind of another sort of strategy was, hey, we've got a weekly 1 hour meeting. And part of that periodically is going to be us talking about where are we heading? Let's collaboratively set goals. Let's figure out where that adds value to the company overall. Let's get some buy-in. And then to the extent that we can portion out to people who's going to own which aspects of it. And there are going to be some duds on the team who aren't going to raise their hand, and that's okay because they're not really going anywhere anyway. But then you find the ways for people to get to push themselves safely, have been part of the decision of, yeah, we want to have, you know, data visualization best practices. It's like, okay, you know what? You run with that. And I think that sometimes is easier to do in-house than agency or consultancy side, because you tend to have a little more flex with your time, but not that hard to sort of figure out what are the strengths of these people. And you know what? The person who has no interest in that, they don't sign up for that. They may still collaborate, see the value, see that other people are working on it. They've now seen that they can say, hey, I think we need to, you know, grow this data science capability. Okay, what can we do? How can you lead that? So to me, in hindsight, and I'm completely sure I am like revisionist historying the shit out of this, was, you know, that this was trying to figure out what could people feel like they had ownership of and that they had a stake in defining what that was, but then also kind of holding them to it. Like, you know, how's that going? And I think back to Mo, your initial question, like you don't want to say, wow, you know R better than I do. So what I need to do is not have you learn R even more. You know, you need to say, hey, how can we bring that to the rest of the team? Not necessarily teach them R, but, you know, let's champion what you're doing, figure out where you fit, figure out how we can support it and ultimately make it contribute to the whole organization.
So I heard you say something, Tim, and I want to just really quickly go back to it. You said something about like really focusing on people's strengths. And like, what book would you recommend?
The only management book I've ever recommended. First, Break All the Rules. Oh my God, I love that book.
Okay. No, I'm just kidding. Because yeah, you're like,
that's nicely, thank you.
Such a fan of Strengths Finders, I know. So
I do not recommend reading Now Discover Your Strengths. First one, loved it. But that's actually a good point. Just to plug that, I mean, the first Break All the Rules like really does say figure out where people thrive. And then I guess in theory, Now Discover Your Strengths says you're going to recognize what your strengths are and focus on those. And you want to have people who have complementary, what like definitionally means there will be people who are better at stuff than you are. And the more you can take that view of we're trying to make the pieces of the puzzle fit together and be effective. And that means even I as a manager means I have some weaknesses that I'm not going to try to fix. Like I'm not going to become the, you know, optimistic cheerleader. Okay. Maybe I need to work on that a little bit.
But okay, so everything that we're talking about talks about kind of trying to pair people with complementary skill sets and, you know, this person's good at this and you can work on that together. I had a conversation a few weeks ago with some peers in the industry, and I was really surprised by this actually, because this person and I have worked together on multiple big projects that have worked really well. And they basically said, well, if I'm struggling with someone, I don't want to work with anyone. I'm a person who prefers to self-solve. I like being a team of one. I like fixing my own issues. I don't like having a team or a network around me. I will go off in a corner and figure out the solution, and I'll let you know when I'm done. And I was really gobsmacked by this because, like I said, I'd worked with this person on multiple big projects and we worked great together. So I was really interested to hear that that was actually their preferred method. Now, obviously, I'm the type of person who likes to work with someone on something, and this person wasn't. But when it comes to managing, how do you manage a person like that when everything we've been talking about is like, you pair this person with that person, these people work together? Like, do you let this person just run on their own, or do you try and bring them in the fold? Like, how do you handle
that? I just say, hey, Tim, do whatever you want, you know? No, actually, that's a really good question, Mo, and I don't know that I've got any kind of definitive answer, because I think actually I'm actually that way. I prefer to take problems away and go over in a corner and try to solve them and then come back and tell you what I've figured out. I do think that there is sort of, you can create a cadence where people can go off and work in their best style and then bring it back to the team. And so actually, again, you know, so many wonderful things I learned from my manager at Land's End, Kirby Wenger. That's kind of what we would do. We'd go off and work. We'd do analysis. We'd do some collaborating it within the week, but then we'd come back as a team and sort of present to each other, here's what I'm thinking, here's what I'm coming up with, here's what I've figured out. And we'd kind of use that time to complement each other's skills and kind of poke holes in it and strengthen it so that we were more ready, each of us, to showcase our analysis to the whole business. And so it's about kind of managing that flow of time for you is time with the team, time reviewing, time presenting, all those kinds of things, stacking that effectively, I think is a really important skill.
You're so nice, which is funny because you kind of kick me in the ass on this particular topic occasionally, rightfully so. It depends that I will cut that out.
No.
Say he encourages you develop on this particular topic rather than kicks in the ass.
Well, because it does depend, right? I think it is really rare for a team to be successful and effective and efficient with everybody working completely in isolation. So even if somebody says, well, I don't really want to collaborate a lot, there's a point where you have to assess, well, how are you being effective for the organization? And if it's somebody who maybe they're amazing, but they literally, you give them a problem, they disappear for a week or 2 weeks and they come back with the solution. There are times where you say, great, how did we as an organization learn about how you went tackling that? That they may still be fine to do that. But Michael, as you were speaking about a little bit, say, well, no, you still have to share your process. There's no way any person who's working in isolation is completely fully rounded and amazing. Right. Like they're going to be weak at some things. So I think there is a role. It doesn't necessarily mean you guys need to go sit in a room and collaborate 8 hours a day. But I think where Michael, you were kind of heading to, just not maybe not putting it as kind of bluntly as I see it, is that it's rarely, unless you want to go hang up your shingle and be an independent consultant and have clients who only want to give you the problem and see the solution. Otherwise, if you're in an organization, and I think that is part of the role of the manager to say, how do we get them engaged? It's possible. I have another example in mind that I'm thinking of where somebody said, you know, I work best alone. I want to move my office. I want to go sit on the other side of the building so I'm not sitting right with the team. I'll be more effective. That's a problem. You know, like that's not going to help the team. And that person may be happy in the short term, but how are they going to grow? How are they going to grow without being exposed to anyone else? So I recognize the need, the desire, but also you've got to, you can't, it's not a team otherwise.
Yeah. Every Tversky needs their condiment, right? And or the other way around. Like that was one of the more cool things about that book was that they were better together than they were by themselves.
Really need to read that
it's
book.
It's
a you really,
really
do.
Good book.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, Mo made it a last call. I don't know if you're aware of that.
So for those not following, we're talking about the Undoing Project again.
Yes, by Mo.
Have either of you gone from where you got elevated within a team and therefore you, somebody who was your peer became somebody who was working for you? I haven't had it happen to me. I watched it happen. I saw the effects of that happening and it not playing out well, but
it's happened to you exactly now. Your boss is your friend, was your friend.
Still is his friend.
Well,
still.
I'm gonna paint both of us as being sufficiently snowflakes that we don't count. We do not generalize. We are a model that does not generalize to the population.
We give each other a wide berth.
Yeah, but I mean that's happened to me recently, and I guess we both knew that it was going to happen, so we had a very frank conversation before it did. About how we wanted our professional relationship to be and our friendship to be. But I think the reason it's worked really well in our case is because we're both incredibly honest with each other, and that definitely hasn't changed. The only thing that I would say is as the person who becomes the manager, you do have to be more careful about what you say, because as a people manager, part of your job now is to protect your team. So you can't just be like, oh, I had a really shit day, all of these things happened, if that's going to impact now someone in your team's,
right,
you know, view of their work, the company, the goals. So you kind of have to protect them. And so the way that we've talked about this, and we've actually had a frank conversation about this, I'm like, as a manager now, my job is to listen to you when it comes to like, if you've had a bad day, it's not your job to listen to me. And that's kind of, I don't know if I'm getting it right. I'll let you know.
So that I feel like you pivoted like from a, I was literally looking from a coworker to a manager coworker that weren't necessarily, but that's actually, this one's actually raises that bigger question of what's your guys' feeling on, there's like the, I call it sort of the old school, like, oh, managers need to keep some distance from their employees. And having had a pretty close and great relationship with most of my past managers who I would say are friends, that has never felt right to me. I think it's a pretty easy thing. Like, there's information Michael is privy to that I don't ask about and he doesn't share. And that's totally fine. But when it comes to the discussions around struggles that are blurring between, you know, it's, you know, emotional, psychological, work, professional, all blurring together, that seems pretty easy. And it's just don't, you know, no favoritism and no, and it'd be a problem if I mean, that's going to be interesting if I become a performance problem, you know, what happens you know, there, or maybe I already am. And we need to have that discussion after this, after we're done recording.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up. Yeah.
I'm really struggling with your point there, Tim. What are you saying about the blurring?
Well, I don't know that it takes brutal honesty to say we are friends and we are therefore going to put these boundaries. Like, it's kind of obvious. Like, it's, to me, it's,
I don't know.
There are people who have said, and I don't know that either of you would fall, that, oh, managers and their employees shouldn't be friends, right? That gets kind of touted out as some people saying, nope, I'm a manager, so we need to back off. I think that's a bunch of crap.
That you're absolutely right, Tim, that people do this very awkwardly and really create tension and problems where there doesn't have to be any. I would say any leadership position that you find yourself in, you will, and actually leadership is a concept, is something you don't really need a specific title to have. You can be a leader in any way. But even if you're helping organize an event for your local analytics community and you're struggling with like getting boxed lunches and the t-shirt orders and all those things, guess what all the people attending the event don't care about? All of your struggles with that. And that's, to your point, Mo, that's the job of a leader. A leader takes that on. And so all of us express leadership in different ways. And that's what that is. It's not that, hey, we can't be friends. We have to be arm's length. It's about, I carry for everyone else's benefit some of the weight, and I don't expose you to that. My job is to block for you so you can succeed.
It's funny, actually. So the company I work at, we do have lots of, you know, fairly young managers, first time they've really managed people. And there's been quite a few examples where people kind of new to people management are like, oh, I'm never coming to Friday drinks. They don't really like ever socialize with their team unless it's like a specific team function.
That's pretentious
I'm obviously not. I'm obviously not one of those people.
You're like, drinks? What?
Yeah.
Oh, hell, drinks. I'm like, drinks, sure, I'll be there. But I do think what becomes, and I think the people that are doing that are making a mistake, because building up personal relationships with your team is also one of the things you need for a high performing team, is a really strong level of trust, which you get from those moments. But it seems to be a mistake that people that are new to management do, of like, I need this hard line. And I think what Michael and I are both saying and agree on is like, you need that hard line to be about protecting your team. Yeah. That doesn't mean that you can't have a great personal relationship with them and have a friendship with them, which extends beyond work, but it means that you still protect them like you're meant to. And that because you've had a wine, it doesn't all, like all the things that you're not meant to talk about.
Right. It's a maturity, right? If you were elevated to that manager, there is an expectation that you're not going to gossip. You're certainly not going to share anything that was shared with you in confidence in a separate manager employee relationship. You still have to stay objective about their performance. There cannot be any romance. So, Michael, get your hand off my knee. But to me, those are all fairly unambiguous things. And I agree, Mo, that I think that there sometimes can be a tendency to say, oh, especially to that, this is the first time I'm a manager. Oh, wait, we used to hang out and bitch about our manager or bitch about the company. It's like, well, yeah, that's going to change a little bit, but absolutely healthy to discuss the company's challenges or things that are frustrating you. And maybe you are in a gray area at that point where are we discussing this as coworkers who are friends, or am I bitching to you as a manager and I expect you to fix it? Because the manager isn't necessarily going to fix it.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, a lot of times when people get twisted on this is because they think that the title somehow confers something to them, but it confers nothing. You're a leader and you're working to become a better leader, or you're not. And what your job title is really almost has zilch to do with that. I would say I've made a ton of mistakes. And I think that's one of the other things somebody mentioned about, you can't say as much as you know a lot of times. And I think that's one of those things that, you know, like I'll see the numbers and be like, well, we're having a rough month. I might say that two people away down the line are like, oh no, we're about to do layoffs. And suddenly I'm having to like, be like, no, we're not doing layoffs. Like we've never done that. Like it's not going to happen. Not in a million years. How could you ever think that? And that's what you have to learn is that people take what you say. If you're in a leadership position and you've got to say it carefully and correctly and think about your communication. So,
that is my favorite when like, well, the VP said this and I'm like, yeah, but you're three levels removed. So if the VP knew that literally the entire department has remobilized to fulfill one of her like idle questions where she was just curious, she would be furious. So
yeah, suggestions become orders, right? That's the thing happens and you just have to.
So how do you, so as a leader, you just watch what you say? Like, I mean, sometimes those questions, so for example, you're part of some leadership meeting, someone asks a question, legit, this happened last week. Do regional customers spend more or less than our metro customers? And it trickles the whole way down. So what, as a leader, you just stop hypothesizing externally, or how do you?
It's, I mean, to me, that's if you're down on the team where it's trickling down to and somebody's like going berserk, I mean, one, that could get back to the person who was asking and doesn't know the level of effort. Right. You may not know the level of effort. If a person who's working for you says, I'm going to need to spend the next week on this, that's exactly where a lower in the organization manager can say, wait a minute, what I'm going to take on is I'm going to go back to that person and say, hey, yep. I know it was a quick question. The length of the question has nothing to do with the length of a level of effort to answer it. How important is it to you to answer? Help me understand. Yeah. And if you're the higher you up you are, yeah, I do think that you need to be careful about who you're saying things to and the nature of the managers, your direct reports who are hearing it, because they're definitely the managers who will run with that and they will shift their entire team to work on something because they don't have that judgment.
The VPS one's question, the people beneath them's job is to figure out, is that a priority for us or not, given everything else? Let me go clarify. Not just to be like, oh, they said something. Let's, okay, everybody, new priority. Go do this now. And everybody, you will have a whole teams of people running around like 5-year-olds playing soccer, right? Everybody's and it's no way to live, right? And that's where a good manager is a stabilizing influence in that context. They're not letting the team get swept around by maybe changing opinions or conversations happening at that level. They're prioritizing effectively. And that's what I mean by being a blocker, is you're blocking that out and creating calm for people to be able to work and do their jobs. Okay, I want to...
I want to ask one more before you try to wrap.
No, I had one more.
You know what? I'll say what my last one is. You say what your last one is. Mo, as our manager, can decide which one
is the tiebreaker. Okay, I like it.
So probably the thing that most drove me out of managing was the non-passion, either low performers or just unmotivated or wrong fit, somebody who liked the idea of analytics more than they actually had an aptitude for doing analytics. That was soul-sucking for me. And it really depended on how supportive the HR department was. So I would love to hear if you guys have thoughts on what about the team members who just aren't in the right position?
Great question. What was your question? But slightly better than that is my question, which is this. How, as a manager of an analyst, do you position and let your analyst fail to help them grow and not hide from them the results and things? So let them sort of see, like, they tried this, they're really passionate about it, and then it kind of came crashing down, and then you come in and use that to help grow and let them learn and that kind of stuff. So where do you...
I see those as separate questions, Mo. Which question would you like to explore further?
Those are very separate questions. Although Michael's question is quite similar to one that I had about basically how do you let people fail but also protect the business, because when an analyst fails and gets numbers wrong, it can actually really impact decisions. and especially where you're not the SME, so you can't check their work. How do you manage that failure?
You take the bullet for them. That's an easy, I mean, to me, you let them fail and then you overtake responsibility for it so that they are comfortable, and it, you take it on you and take the brunt of it as much as you possibly can. But
see, quick answer. Now we can move on to your question, which I actually thought was super interesting. But to be fair, I'm incredibly lucky because my entire team, we all love our jobs. We're all super passionate. Like, we all have this like great vibe. And I've actually given a lot of thought before about the fact that one of the things I struggle with in like my little team is like, we're not that diverse in that we're four women. We all think very similarly. We all value like a high level of honesty, which trickles down to like data integrity in our work. But like, I'm really lucky because I don't have anyone in my team who is like that, not into it, not motivated.
But at past roles, have you not, maybe you haven't managed them, but have you, I mean, surely them. You've come across those people, right?
Well, that's all the time we have, so.
But I guess I also don't begrudge those people. So it's something that we were chatting about not long ago with one of the product managers who was like asking us all about how much we tinker after work. And he was like, how much do you tinker in your trade? Like, whether you're an engineer or an analyst or whatever, like how much are you playing around with things after work, doing work-related stuff to keep ahead in your industry? And it, kind of everyone had different answers. And one of the guys was like, he's an engineer, and he's like, I leave work at 5 and that is my family time. And Saturday and Sunday is my family time. I have no interest in doing anything related to work when I step out of that door. I don't want to be like at conferences. I don't want to be reading stuff. Like, I learn during my time at my job. And when I leave, I leave. And I also have respect for that. Like, their work is not the sole part of their life. It's they do it to get money.
I think you're putting up, there's a false equivalency here. I think you can absolutely, some people can, I can't have that work-life balance, but that's still, there is still, okay, on the job, are you really engaged, really looking to grow? Because yes, you can have people, and I have actually managed these people who were like, nope, I pretty much want my job 3 years from now to be the job that I have today, which is actually lethal in an analytics context. And those are people that I want to figure out how to get into another role where maybe they can be successful, but I don't think there is long-term team supporting for that.
Sorry, when you say 3 years though, and I guess maybe this is where I'm misunderstanding, I don't think there's anything wrong with being like, I'm a senior analyst. I still want to be a senior analyst in 3 years. Where it comes down to is, do they want to be doing literally the exact same task?
That's what I'm saying.
And they don't want to learn
anything. What's our process?
If that's the person, you've got to get
exactly,
rid of them.
Right? So I think you can be very, I want to be doing, I want to have grown. I want the organization to be doing cooler, bigger, richer stuff. And you know what? I'm also very good at leaving at 5 o'clock and being checked out. I think it's not me, but I'm totally, those people I'm fine with. The ones who have said, when I ask someone, why are you not managing to go take that statistics class that is offered during work time from a college, and you transferred into the customer insights and analytics group, and the response is, well, I'm not really that into data. I'm like, literally, we were trying to let you grow while being paid and doing your homework on company time, and you're not interested? I'm like, it doesn't mean that she's not a valuable employee of the company, but I do think that's really sad when people say it's a job. I'm going to do it for 40 to 45 hours a week, and I don't find the work engaging enough to be wanting to push it forward. That's a problem. If it's not a fine line. It's very, very clear.
If they're good at their job,
it's motivation, right?
I don't think there's a fine line when it comes to analytics. I think if you're in a process, if you're assembling widgets on a production line, or doing a non-manual labor task equivalent, yes, they're absolutely there's value in people who you want to say, like, you're going to be an amazing executive assistant and you'll still, you know, maybe continue to grow. That's fantastic, because you want somebody who is going to be long tenured in one role. I have not found an analytics team context where that level of repetition is, because those are the people, you know what? They're the ones who will say, I spend 4 hours a week producing this report and I'm going to have zero motivation to figure out how to automate it. That is not productive.
But okay, that's where the difference is. If that person is like, okay, I'm building dashboards every single day and all I do is turn out dashboards, and they're never trying to make the process kind of more efficient or better, that's where, for me, the line
is. It's not a gray. It's not a fine line. It's black and white. Oh, sorry, I'm interrupting you. Carry on, Mo.
No. But I don't feel like it is black and white, because there are people who do their 9 to 5 that want to get their paycheck, that are not that interested in their work. That's their thing. That's okay. That doesn't mean they're a bad employee.
Not in analytics. Nope.
Interesting.
Tim, you just need to work on their growth mindset. If only you could help them have a growth mindset, then they would be okay.
I don't think you can be in analytics and have that mindset and be effective in analytics. But yeah.
This is actually, I love this, because I think you guys actually disagree, and
we're out of time.
We have so not any more time to talk about this. But actually, I'm intrigued by this, so we might have to come back to this. Okay, we will need to do last calls, and so let's start with you, Mo.
So I'm back in the old books again, and I've been playing around following some of the examples from a book called Practical Guide to Cluster Analysis in R. I'm not going to attempt the first name.
Sounds like a page turner.
The surname's Sambara, which we can share online. But I don't know. I'm just finding sometimes I get in rabbit holes where you're trying to do something online and you go to a blog, you go to another page, you go to another, and like they all conflict with each other. And sometimes if you find a really solid book that takes you from where to go, I actually am finding that sometimes is a little bit easier, which is the same reason I really like Ellie Fate's book as well, because you can work through something rather than getting stuck going through like the 50 different tabs you now have open.
I like
Very
it.
Nice.
Are you? All right. I hope you're reading that during work hours and your manager assigned to read it. Mine is, I think Mo and I have both recommended different sort of palette selection type sites and stuff, but Flowing Data had picular.co. So it's picular.co. And it's like Google for palettes. And it's like you can put in a website, you can put in a color, you can put in kind of whatever you want, and it will generate a palette. And there are various sites that do this sort of thing, but this one actually is a pretty clean interface and kind of cool. And I'm always a fan of things that will not make me choose colors, but will choose colors for me.
Very nice.
Michael, what you got?
Well, not much, because I'm on the road and I forgot to think of a last call. But last show, I talked about the Digital Analytics Hub, which is coming up. So if you can, go to that. But more importantly, if you are in the 3 or 4 states near Atlanta, Georgia, at the end of October, we're having a symposium and there's some very excellent speakers. And I really want to encourage people to come if you're around. Or even if you're far, far away in Croatia, you know who you are. Come on over to the U.S. You can stay at my house and we'll have a good time. And anyways, so yeah, the DAA symposium in Atlanta at the end of October. I have to say that because now I'm on the board of the DAA. So. Just trying to be transparent about promotional things. Anyways.
You should be protecting the team, Helbs.
Protecting. I can't say nearly as much. Yeah, actually, I do need to think about that in the context. Never mind. my role as a board member I'm not sure what I'm supposed to or not supposed to share. Anyways, listen, if you've been listening, I hope you're still listening at this point, we would love to hear from you. How have you successfully managed an analyst? What are some key takeaways you could help others gain from your experiences? We'd love to hear about it. Best ways to reach us, Measure Slack, our Facebook page, or on Twitter, or our website, analyticshour.io. Remember, if you are not a manager and you want to be one, go talk to people who are and learn from their experiences and become a great manager someday. Learn from the best. And like me, I learn from the best, which is my two co-hosts, Mo and Tim, and recommending to all of you that you keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Measure Slack group. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io, facebook.com/analyticshour, or at analyticshour on Twitter.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
That's right, folks. If you're listening at home, we basically talk about nothing else but the homework that Matt Kershaw has assigned us.
Which remains undone.
Is that a proper, is that a response, or what do people say when they say?
Yeah, you just answer it normally, like, how are you?
But if you say, how are you, I say, I'm fine. If you say, how are you going, do you say, I'm...
How's it going? You could say, I'm fine. It's the same. Yeah.
How's it going is different from how are you going.
You are the it, Tim. You are the
we
it.
We will take it up with your manager.
I am. Right off the top, guys, I think, you know, one of the key things is to really not explain what you mean when you ask them to do something. That's a key.
And I have a question. How do you manage a particularly passive-aggressive, analyst?
I don't know how you manage it. I do basically a bad job.
I figured out the answer to your question. How do you motivate that employee who's not motivated?
What is it?
You help them understand that if they automate stuff and do it faster, they get a longer lunch break.
Rock flag and management.